Hello and welcome to this week's Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, a new and more realistic way of diagnosing how bad a case of prostate cancer is. Brave souls in Brisbane who are allowing themselves to be infected with malaria so millions of lives can be saved. And are you allergic to antibiotics? It's a common question doctors ask, or at least they should, before they write out an antibiotic script. And as you'll hear, there are a lot of people who say yes. In fact, according to a paper in today's edition of the Medical Journal of Australia, the proportion of older people who are labelled as antibiotic allergic is huge, with enormous implications. But it turns out many have been misled or been wrongly labelled. With me in the Melbourne studio is one of the lead authors, Jason Tribbiano, who's an infectious disease physician at Austin Health and the University of Melbourne. Welcome to the Health Report, Jason.
Thank you very much.
Now, you've done previous work in this to work out what proportion of the general public is antibiotic allergic.
Yes, we have. So previously we've, with the help of the National Centre of Antimicrobial Stewardship, we've done a national survey of antibiotic allergy labels in patients admitted to hospitals. And I guess disturbingly, almost 18% of patients are in fact labelled as allergic. And that's much higher in people that are higher users of antibiotics, our most vulnerable patients. So we got a sense from our previous work that certainly a lot of people are labelled. And it really spurred us to have a look at what type of labels people had, particularly again amongst our elderly patients.
Because they've been on antibiotics longer and more vulnerable, presumably.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, accumulation and also usage in current means.
So how is allergy to antibiotics classified? Because it's important we understand that because when we get into your study to understand how you've analysed the data.
Yeah, sure. So there's multiple ways of classifying it, but I think the easiest way is to break up to two big groups. Those are that are non-immune mediated or are really drug side effects. We call them type A. And on the other side...
So this isn't an allergy at all. This is like taking any medication. You get an upset tummy, you get a headache, you feel lousy.
Absolutely.
It's not an allergy. It's just something in the drug.
Yeah, it's a known drug side effect without actually a true allergy. And then on the flip side, you've got type B allergies. These are people that have, you know, true immune-mediated allergies. They have a very bad rash or they have anaphylaxis. So there are two broad categories that we try and distinguish in terms of antibiotic allergy labels.
So anaphylaxis is where your lips swell or you get breathing problems and
you
get a big lumpy rash in your body.
Yeah, hives or, welts. Mm.
So, okay, so that's kind of the classification. What did you do in this study?
So this was a study that we performed at the Austin Hospital and Alfred Hospital in Melbourne. Effectively, back in May, June 2015, we looked at all the patients that were admitted under the general medical units at those two hospitals. And then we broke those patients up into those that had an allergy label and those that didn't. We then went with those people that had an allergy.
Just before you go on.
Yeah, sure.
They had a label. Who put that label on? That was self-administered or it was on their notes? What was the story?
It's historical. The way they get there is there's multiple pathways. Either a patient recalls they're allergic and tells a doctor or pharmacist on admission, or it's there from a previous admission, or it's there from a doctor's letter that's sent in from the community. So there's multiple ways it gets there through those means that we've described. So we looked at people that had an allergy label and those that didn't, and then we went back to those people that had an allergy label and asked them about them and compared it to what we had recorded in our hospital system.
What sort of things did they tell you?
Yeah, well, that was interesting. You know, 25% of patients actually described a completely different reaction to what was listed, which is, I guess, disturbing, particularly if it's a serious allergy, but also potentially we're not labelling people correctly when they come in the door of the hospital.
So give us a flavour.
So, for example, somebody will say they're allergic to penicillin, it gets labelled as allergic, and then the patient tells you that actually I just had some nausea when I had penicillin, I completed the course. Another example might be I had a rash from a viral infection, I got penicillin, and I was labelled as penicillin allergic from that point on as well. So,
or my mummy told me I was allergic.
Exactly right. My mummy said never to have penicillin again, but I'm not sure what the reaction was, and that unknown group is quite a large portion as well. So there's lots of different descriptions that people were able to give us.
And presumably some would have had a true allergic reaction, but it wasn't a bad one.
Absolutely. So and there's spectrums along the way, and some people have mild hives that got better when they stopped the drug. And as you mentioned before, some people have that lip swelling and anaphylaxis all the way through, and that description is really, really important about what antibiotics are given in hospital.
So which antibiotics were they saying they were allergic to? Was it just simply the commonest ones indiscriminately?
Yeah. I mean, penicillin by far and away from a historical means stands out. I think well and truly over 10% of the population surveyed had a penicillin allergy. And then sulfurs is another big group that people are presumably allergic to.
So Bactrim and Septrim would be the two, Cotrimoxazole would be the sort of...
You know, absolutely. The other sulfur drugs is that many people say they're allergic to sulfur drugs and they weren't in fact antibiotic sulfur drugs. And there's new, not new, but quite a lot of data that suggests those people with non-antibiotic sulfur allergy are actually not allergic to sulfur antibiotics as well. So that label's important.
Why are you worried about this? I mean, what's the implication? Presumably there are plenty of other antibiotics around.
Yeah, I think that's half the problem. We're fast running out of antibiotics. The antibiotic pipeline is drying up and we have to use them better. We're using more restricted antibiotics, which generates antimicrobial resistance. And we're really, as infectious disease doctors, keen to prevent that. So if somebody has a penicillin allergy and they could use penicillin and we're using other restricted antibiotics, well, that has the potential to drive antibiotic resistance and a whole host of other complications.
So what was the proportion of people? I'm not sure we actually said that. I've lost track. But 1 in 4 people said they were antibiotic allergic. So that's a big number.
It's a big number.
And what proportion of them didn't have an allergy or had an allergy that was so mild you weren't too worried about it?
Yeah, so quite a lot. So if we break it up into people who would consider maybe a low-risk allergy, they're people that maybe had a simple rash 10 years ago, or they had a drug side effect, or they had no idea what the reaction was when they were a child, that made up almost 63% of the allergies recorded. And if you look at the subgroup, almost 20% actually just had a drug side effect. So in fact, we talk about allergies, but many of the population actually didn't have an allergy at all. They just had a drug side effect.
And some of them, according to your paper, had already had antibiotics that they were supposedly allergic to with no problems.
Absolutely. So, I mean, this is another evolving field. We know that all penicillins are not the same. And whilst we used to think that, you know, when allergic to one penicillin, allergic to them all, in fact, it's probably due to just side chains of antibiotics that we're allergic to. And a large portion
of the chemicals.
Yeah, absolutely.
A change to the antibiotic.
Yeah, rather than the core structure. So, I mean, a lot of patients were given the same class of antibiotic or the same culprit antibiotic with no adverse event recorded. So it either means two things. One, they were never allergic, or in fact, they just got a very isolated allergy, which has also implications for antibiotic usage.
Now, you asked them whether they'd be prepared to be challenged with an antibiotic that they were allegedly allergic to.
So we offered people a hypothetical oral rechallenge. It was a standardized question, effectively saying, well, if you were considered to have a low-risk allergy, would you be willing to be rechallenged in a supervised environment? And we were surprised how engaged our respondents were, and just over 50% of respondents said, yes, we'd be happy to be rechallenged. So people are willing to rechallenge their allergy labels as well, which was really encouraging.
So what's the story here? Somebody's listening to this and they believe that they're allergic to antibiotics. They're okay to take it if it's just been a mild reaction. What are we saying to people listening?
Well, I think it has to be in consultation with your primary caregiver. I think that
they're often the person who's mislabeled it, presumably.
Yeah, so maybe there's twofold. There's one, education. I think we have to go back to the drawing board in terms of how we educate medical professionals. But also, patients can question their allergy label and talk it over with their doctor. They can say, well, I was labelled as penicillin allergic, but in fact it's nausea. And that doctor will say, actually, that's a side effect. We can remove that allergy label. So there's some simple measures that can be done.
And
we certainly don't want people that have a true allergy to go and take an antibiotic they're allergic to. I think this also has the other flip side of really working on drug safety as well. But there's lots of methods that we should really be exploring in terms of rechallenging people with low risk, or in some cases really undergoing skin prick or skin prick testing or oral challenges in hospital.
Because as you get older, you could be undergoing chemotherapy or having a transplant or something like that. And it's important that you have a full range of antibiotics available to you. So in those sorts of situations, you might actually go to a specialist to be tested if you think you are allergic, truly allergic.
Absolutely. And that's the groups we're targeting at the Austin and Peter Mac, where we've set up some dedicated antibiotic allergy clinics. We're really trying to get, you know, immunosuppressed or people with low immunities or cancer, as you mentioned, and those people that need frequent antibiotics that have an allergy label that could be revised, we're really keen to try and sort that out through formal skin testing. And I think that's going to form a very unique arm of antimicrobial stewardship in the future.
And if your mummy told you you're antibiotic allergic, it's reasonable to just question that advice.
We certainly should be questioning that, that's for sure.
Jason, thanks for joining us.
Not a problem.
Jason Tribbiano, who's an infectious disease physician at Austin Health and the University of Melbourne. And you're listening to the Health Report here on RN with me, Norman Swan. One of the diseases which is holding back economic development in many emerging nations is malaria. It's a parasite carried by mosquitoes causing, and it depends on the type of malaria, recurrent debilitating fevers, kidney failure, brain damage and even death. There are an astounding 200 million cases each year with hundreds of thousands of deaths. The good news is that the number of deaths have halved in the last 15 years and the tantalising prospect of malaria eradication is now considered a realistic goal. Australian government money has been critical in this fight, but reinvestment is now due. And if it doesn't happen, malaria could easily be unleashed again. But other good news is that fascinating research into human guinea pigs in Queensland is accelerating the development of new malaria drugs and telling us a lot about some of the old ones. In the last few weeks, there have been a wad of papers published from the Brisbane Group, which is based at the Queensland Institute of Medical Research. One of the researchers there is Professor James McCarthy, who's in our Brisbane studio. Welcome, James.
Hello, Norman.
Just talk us through those statistics in the last 15 years, because we often hear bad news stories, but this is an amazingly good news story.
Yes, it's been a really good story. The really deployment of the methods that we know cure malaria and prevent it are when they're actually rolled out in a systematic way have really made a huge difference. I'm talking about bed nets for young children and mothers to sleep under in developing countries, which have dramatically reduced the incidence of malaria, as well as diagnostics tests, which can tell the difference between malaria and other diseases, and also drugs that really work rather than drugs that are failing, such as the chloroquine treatment, which was really a very old treatment, which was failing.
And bed nets work everywhere or just somewhere?
Well, it's a complicated story. It depends on the mosquito biting behaviour, but in many parts of the world, the mosquitoes bite during the evening when people are sleeping in their beds, and sleeping under a bed net actually protects both the people sleeping under the bed net but also people around them who aren't bitten by mosquitoes that die because of the insecticides in the bed net.
Because it's impregnated. And we forget that malaria is a childhood disease, by and large.
Yeah. Yes, we think about it as a disease that tourists get, but the people who really suffer most from it are very small children and pregnant women, and these are the groups that we really need to develop treatments for, and they're most among the most difficult groups to actually develop new drugs and vaccines for.
Now, we're going to be talking about drugs, but you keep on hearing about vaccines for malaria. There's been a big push over many, many years, both in Queensland and in Melbourne, at the Walter and Eliza Hall, to try to develop a malaria vaccine. Do we have one?
Well, last year a vaccine was actually licensed by the European Medicines Agency. The problem with the vaccine, it's only partially protective and the protection is relatively short-lived. So the dilemma that public health experts have is, do you deploy a vaccine that may be 30 to 40% effective across the whole population when we've already got a very crowded immunisation schedule? So you really need to know that a vaccine of that efficacy is going to be good value for money from a public health perspective.
Now, whilst there's this great news, there's also news that there's this very resistant form of malaria emerging from the Mekong Delta in Vietnam.
Yes, that's correct. So it's been recognised for several years now that the malaria parasite in those regions of the world is becoming resistant to the artemisinin drugs, which you would remember with the Nobel Prize were given last year for their discovery. And that's a real worry to us, because if that was to spread, much of the progress that we've been making over these last several years will go backwards.
Hence the work that you're doing at QIMR. Just tell us about this incredible model that you've got based on the blood of this poor woman on the Solomon Islands who was volunteering in an aid effort and got malaria.
So the real problem is that as malaria prevalence decreases, you need to go to more and more remote places to test to see if the drug works. And you need to work in populations where if the drug doesn't work, the outcome might be really bad. So we need a way to actually test malaria drugs in a safer environment, and therefore we need
and
to...
And faster, presumably.
Yes, and therefore, as you call them, human guinea pigs, although we call them healthy volunteers, these people who are willing to give up their time and come and experience malaria so that we can test the drugs in them in a very safe way.
Just briefly tell us the story of this woman.
So this woman was an aid volunteer in the Solomon Islands, and she contracted malaria and came back to Brisbane and presented to our hospital with malaria. And we'd already got... permission from our ethics committee to collect blood from people with malaria for use in later clinical trials. So she basically donated half a unit of her blood, and she had the less common form of, and less lethal form of malaria, Plasmodium vivax. And since then, we've been able to use her blood to give this infection to healthy volunteers and then test to see whether the drugs actually work against Plasmodium vivax.
So you've kept the parasites alive in her blood. So what do you actually do? Well, you just inject a drop of their blood under the skin?
Yeah, so effectively it's a tiny, tiny blood transfusion, except the blood has also got malaria parasites in it. And then we use a very sensitive DNA test that can measure the parasites in the blood upwards of a week before people become sick. So we can follow somebody for a considerable period of time and test to see if the drug is working before they become unwell and get really very precise information about how active the drug is and how quickly it kills the malaria.
And if it doesn't work, what do you do
then? Well, we've got licensed drugs that work very well, and that's the good thing, is that we know that this woman was cured by the common antimalarial drugs that we use in our clinic all the time.
Now, let's just come through some of these papers. You've got a whole sheath of papers you've published in the last few weeks. You actually did a paper on an old drug called mefloquine. Why did you do it on an old drug?
Well, because mefloquine was licensed more than 20 years ago, and we have a lot of information about how well it works, what level of drug needs to be in the blood to cure people. So we were able to then use that drug in our test system to establish whether or not our system would predict how well the drug would do when it was treated, when people with severe malaria were treated with it. And this gave us the confidence then to actually move on to experimental drugs where we could reference back to the old drugs. And it really saves 2 years and millions of dollars being able to do these studies in this way.
So that was a proof of concept.
Yes.
And you had trouble getting that published. I mean, eventually it took years to get that paper published.
Yes, that's correct, because of the usual reasons why it takes a while to publish these sorts of papers. So I don't need to go into that on this program, but issues of novelty and interest are always difficult to get editors to take notice of.
So now you've got what they say in the business is a platform for studying drugs. Now, are these your drugs that you developed in Queensland?
No, so the really good news is that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have funded a consortium of what we call a product development partnership, in this case Medicines for Malaria, which are brokering, bringing drugs from big international drug companies into the field. So we're actually working on four new drugs at the moment, all of which have really high promise for actually making a huge difference to malaria. So the drugs are brought from overseas to our clinic, and we're first testing them for safety, and then we get really rapid data on efficacy as well.
So then you can go out into the field. Now, you just did a study on a relative of chloroquine, that older drug for malaria, and found that it worked, but there was literally a sting in the tail.
Yeah, so this is a drug called piperaquine, which was discovered by the Chinese in the 1960s. And the interesting thing about this drug is it works very well against killing drug-sensitive parasites, but has an effect of actually permitting the transmission stage of the parasite staying in the blood of people. So what ends up happening is that people are cured of their malaria. They don't feel sick anymore, but circulating in their blood are the transmission stage of the parasite that can actually then be transmitted to people in their own village. So paradoxically, they become a danger to the people around them. And therefore, we need to develop drugs which will block transmission of malaria as well as making people feel better.
So just to explain that, it's not like a bacterial infection where you get staphylococcus in your blood and it's staphylococcus. The parasite goes into your blood, and because it's kind of a living organism being, if you like, it actually goes through developmental stages. And depending on the developmental stage, it can either, which is why you get recurrent fevers, because it comes out, causes a fever, goes back. And there's one stage, which is if you happen to get bitten by a mosquito, just at that stage, the mosquito will become infected.
Yeah, so it's an interesting story. There are males and females, and the malaria parasite actually has sex inside of the mosquito before it actually reproduces in the mosquito. So we need
too
to
much
be able
information,
to,
James.
Yes.
And you've got good news on a recent new drug. Well, first of all, you discovered a new drug that didn't work at all.
Yes, well, it's also paradoxically a good story if we can actually discover whether a drug is not worth pursuing, because that saves a lot of time and money. So working with collaborators from Switzerland, from a drug company called Actelion, we were able to show that their particular drug was not worth continuing with, because it was never going to be active enough to be a useful drug. And that, in fact, is a success for our system.
So shame for the company, but it saved a lot of time and effort. And then you found one that's working really well.
Yes, well, we're working with Medicines for Malaria for a synthetic version of the artemisinin drug, which is the one that won the Nobel Prize. So this could be manufactured using chemistry. And this drug is really very promising and very powerful, and we tested it in our system. We're able to figure out what the right dose is to carry it forward into combination therapy, which is the next step.
But in fact, you found it's curative even by itself.
Yes, absolutely.
So all that's good news, but the message here is that if we take our foot off the pedal, particularly at budget time here in Australia, and don't refinance the effort, we could find ourselves back, and it's happened before, we could find ourselves back with a very bad malaria pandemic.
Yeah, so the Global Fund for AIDS, TB and Malaria has to be refunded every 3 years, and we think the outputs have been really great, and we need to keep that particular activity going until we get these new drugs that can eradicate malaria.
James, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Professor James McCarthy is an infectious disease physician at the Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital and a researcher at the QIMR Berghofer Medical Research Institute, also in Brisbane. One of the challenges when you're diagnosed with cancer is being sure what stage it's at. The staging can decide what treatment you should have and what your prospects are for survival and cure. For most tumours, it's a complicated process involving the size of the tumour, what it looks like under the microscope, the extent to which it's spread, and increasingly what the genes in the cancer are showing. Prostate cancer has been even messier, but some clarity may be coming from a new staging system developed at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. One of the people responsible is Professor of Pathology, Urology and Oncology at Hopkins, Jonathan Epstein, who's in Queensland as we speak to present his findings on the Gold Coast at the annual conference of the Urological Society of Australia and New Zealand. Jonathan Epstein, welcome to Australia and the Health Report.
Thank you.
So it is complicated with prostate cancer. It's called the Gleason system. Take us with, you know, we've only got a few minutes, but, you know, just take us through what the Gleason system is and what the problem is.
Yes, the Gleason system was developed by pathologist Donald Gleason in 1967 through 1973. And it's a complicated system where you add the most common pattern and the least most common pattern seen under the microscope together to result in a score. And the score ranges from 2 to 10, 2 being good tumors, 10 being very aggressive tumors, which often kill patients. But it gets even more complicated because, for example, you could have a 7, and that 7 could be either mostly 3, which is good, plus a pattern 4, which is not as good, or mostly 4, which is, again, aggressive, and the lesser amount of pattern 3.
So we just need to explain that a little bit more, because when they do multiple biopsies in the gland, one might be, oh, that biopsy looks pretty good and the tissue is quite calm, but this one looks really nasty, and you kind of add up the nasty bits versus the calm bits and come to a score.
Correct. And again, the score, based on what Gleason did way back in the 60s and 70s, was 2 to 10. But what it's changed in recent times is that we no longer grade 2 through 5. We start pretty much the grading system at 6. So if you're a person who gets a biopsy and you have the best possible tumor present under the microscope, we would give it a 6, which is out of kilter, and patients are confused because the score theoretically goes from 2 to 10, but they're given a 6.
And then if you get a 7, it could be a good 7 or a bad 7, as you just alluded to before.
Yeah, correct. A 7 could be anything from an 88% cure rate down to about a, you know, about a 65% cure rate.
And I read a paper recently where if you present the same prostate tissue to different pathologists, they come up with scaringly different conclusions.
Yeah, it is a problem. I mean, there are some grades under the microscope that are classic, and pretty much most pathologists should be in agreement, but a lot depends on the expertise of the pathologist, and there are some areas where, because the grading system has changed over time, some pathologists may not be quite up to speed what's the current way of grading it, and may be grading it incorrectly based on current approaches.
So what have you done?
So basically, I'm an unusual pathologist in that most pathologists don't talk to patients. I talk to several patients a day.
Most pathologists don't talk. I mean, that's the first.
Correct. Yeah, so I talk to several patients a day because they have their cases sent to me based on finding me on the internet or in layperson's books, et cetera. And I would find that they did have this apprehension that they were considering, for example, undergoing watchful waiting for good prostate cancer, but they were given a Gleason 6 out of 10, and that scared them. Or they, again, were given a 7 out of 10, thought it was a death sentence, where in fact most of them had potentially excellent prognosis. So I basically thought to say, if we were just coming up with a system right today, not forgetting what was done in the 60s and 70s, what would be the simplest grading system that we could have that would be intuitive for patients with prostate cancer? And came up with a 1 through 5, 1 being good, 5 being bad, again, very understandable, and gets rid of all the confusion that we have with the 3 plus 4 versus 4 plus 3, or a scale that goes from 6 to 10.
So it sounds simple, but is there complexity behind it?
No, it's actually quite simple for pathologists. It's still based on kind of the current approach to Gleason, so most pathologists can deal with it. I think like anything else in time, changes in medicine take years sometimes to go into effect. So what's currently being recommended is that in pathology reports, we report the Gleason system, but then side by side, we give the new grading system 1 through 5. And the hope over a period of time is that eventually Gleason will be dropped and we'll have a simple 1 through 5 grading system for prostate cancer.
So take us through 1 to 5 and tell us what the outcomes are for each of the scores.
So if you have a grade 1, you literally have no chance of that tumor ever spreading outside the prostate. And if your prostate comes out and it's a pure grade 1, you're 100% cured. If you have a grade 1 a biopsy, there's always an issue with prostate and sampling that they may miss some higher grade or worse tumor. But even then, with that inherent sampling problem, if you have a grade 1 on biopsy, you have a 96 to 97% cure rate. A grade 2, you have an 88% cure rate. Grade 3 drops to about 65%. Grade 4, around 50%. And grade 5, around 25% cure rate.
And how have you verified that? Because one of the problems with any sort of testing is knowing how valid it is.
Yeah, so we initially did this study in 2013 just based on patients from Johns Hopkins. And then basically, you know, I realized if this was going to be something that we could potentially sell to the rest of the world to use, it needed to be verified with other institutions and larger groups of patients. So I gathered together a multi-institutional study, including an institution from outside the United States, over 20,000 patients, and we verified it. And what we used as the outcome, because that was what was available, was the risk of being cured biochemically, meaning you take out your prostate and the PSA never goes up. Subsequently, there
have been... Just to explain, the PSA test, whilst it might be unreliable as a screening test, it's a very reliable way of following somebody after they've had cancer.
Correct. Once you take out the prostate, you don't have a source of PSA, so it's a very sensitive means of saying, has your cancer come back? And then subsequently, there's more recently been several studies showing the new grading system correlates with death due to prostate cancer as well, with longer follow-up. So that's been very satisfying as well.
Does it change treatment?
So in general, it changes patients' perception of what cancer they have, which can affect treatment. So if you're trying to recommend a patient to undergo active surveillance or synonymously watchful waiting, and they have a Gleason 3 plus 3 equals 6, many of them will feel uncomfortable doing so because 6 doesn't sound such low grade. So it's a perception. Whereas if you tell them you have a grade 1, the lowest grade possible, the hope is that those patients will go on active surveillance, feel more comfortable doing so, and stay the course. Similarly, if you tell somebody they have a 3 plus 4 equals 7, I've talked to patients who feel they think it's almost a death sentence, and 7 is closer to 10 than it is to 2, when in fact, again, they have an 88% cure rate, and some of them may also be candidates for watchful waiting if they're older and have some comorbidity. And if we tell them they have a grade 2 out of 5, again, that's hopefully something we can sell them, that they may have a tumor that we don't have to be as aggressive with.
So for consumers in Australia, are pathologists in Australia doing it?
Yeah, so the Royal College of Pathology in Australia and New Zealand has accepted it, and the World Health Organization just came out in 2016 has accepted it. So it's starting. It's probably starting more in some of the major academic institutions, and it'll take time to probably filter out to the communities, but it should hopefully be prevalent in a few years in Australia as well.
Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
I appreciate it very much.
Jonathan Epstein, who's Professor of Pathology, Urology and Oncology at Johns Hopkins University Medical School in Baltimore. I'm Norman Swan. This has been the Health Report.